Hello, listener. This is Brian, and I just want to let you know about a special event we're premiering in the month of September that we're calling Many-Sided Saturdays. It's basically what you get if you smash together actual play with Saturday morning cartoons. And there is simply no game more Saturday morning cartoon coded than Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast. Every Saturday in September, starting at 10 a.m. Eastern on the Many-Sided Media YouTube page, we are going to be airing our season of Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast. Plus, we will also be airing episodes of the award-winning Yazeba show by Jeff Stormer. That means there will be three back-to-back-to-back episodes of Yazeba's every Saturday morning in September, starting at 10 a.m. Eastern. But we are not just airing reruns. No, no, no. On the last Saturday of September, we are going to be premiering two brand new episodes featuring special guests like Jay Stroutman from Planet Arcana, Cameron Stripmatter from The Panic Table, and Olympic gold medalist Lori Hernandez. So tune in to the Many-Sided Media YouTube channel every Saturday in September starting at 10 a.m. Eastern to hear some great stories from Yazeba's Bed and Breakfast on Many-Sided Saturdays. We'll see you there. Hey, Elliot.
Hey, Brian.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Kenna Alexander, the designer of Coyote and Crow and the owner of Coyote and Crow Games. Kenna, welcome to the table. So good to have you.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. It's good to be here.
We really appreciate you being here. This is going to be great.
Yeah.
We wanted to bring you on to talk about this game, the world building and the design of the base game, and how you're looking to support it in the future with like your recent crowdfunder. But to start us off, this game came out about 4 years ago. I'm curious about what the biggest lessons you've learned in those intervening 4 years about this game. What have you learned from 4 years of it being out, 4 years of player feedback, and 4 years of reflecting on the choices you made when designing this game?
Yeah, I honestly, I could almost turn that into a book pitch. It's fascinating to me how, you know, there's that whole thing on about intelligence where like, if you're just smart enough to know how much you don't know. And I think I hit that curve pretty quickly and it began to realize like, oh, I'm not looking at a pond. I'm looking at an ocean of knowledge that I do not have. And you know, that's both good and bad, right? For a person who wants to learn, that's a great challenge. I think when the game was launched on Kickstarter, I really honestly had the vision of it hitting a few hundred people, and I had built the game with a very perfectly parallel mindset of two goals that were running alongside each other. One was is to give gamers and people who were already into TTRPGs a view inside native futurism in a way that like respected kind of the general vibe of RPGs at the time. I wanted kind of like a medium crunch. I wanted some pretty art. I wanted it to feel like it sat along a shelf along with D&D and Pathfinder and Shadowrun and those others, and like it fit in with those. And on the other hand, I also wanted it to be an introduction to native players who had never played an RPG before, but were maybe going to be drawn to it because they saw themselves on the cover. And I think the lesson I learned there is that I should have listened to Mr. Miyagi from Karate Kid, which is like this idea of, you know, if you get in the middle of the road, you just get squished by cars going in both directions. And I really have taken that lesson to heart, because while some gamers have appreciated the world building and the content, I don't think I did a service to the crunch or lack of crunch factor for the game. And then on the other side of things with natives, I don't think a $70 RPG hardback book that is primarily in hobby game stores is going to be reaching very many natives who don't have access to that kind of stuff. So, and it's gonna scare them off. I mean, frankly, you know, 500 page books scare off a lot of people from RPGs in general, right? So I've learned those lessons, and for me now, it's a lot more about approachability, about accessibility, and finding new ways to bring players in and to not scare them off from that big thick book.
So I'm very interested kind of in some of the stuff you said there, and maybe want to dig in a bit on it more. When you think about kind of, I think even with like this Kickstarter you're doing next of like bringing Coyote and Crow digital, is that like accessibility part of a response to kind of what you've learned in not being able to get this to as many native players as you'd hoped?
Yeah, absolutely. I think as a very specific example, we had an event maybe 6 months ago at a longhouse here in the Pacific Northwest. I live in Seattle, and it was down, you know, about an hour south of Seattle. It was a great event. It was a lot of locals from the colleges who are native. It's a high population of native folks in the college. And so we had this big indigenous futurist event where the primary focus was like people sort of getting a learn to play Coyote and Crow experience. And the thing that I took away from it was a very specific man who was probably, I don't know, in his 40s. And he obviously had never been involved in any kind of modern hobby gaming at all. And I saw the look on his face as we spent like 20 minutes maybe explaining the general world building, and then another 20 minutes of like what is a role-playing game, and then 20 minutes of like how to make a character, and then 20 minutes of these are the base rules to play the game. He had completely glazed over. He had tuned out. He had no idea what was happening. And so I think with what I'm trying to bring in for Coyote and Crow Digital, for example, is I think VTTs take out so much of that cognitive load, right? Like they reduce that factor by so much. If you have a good game master telling a story in a VTT, you pull so much back from the player's mental like weight that they can focus more on what does my character do and what do I want to do in this game and what kind of story do I want to tell. And I think that's a great tool. And then there's the more practical side of VTTs, right, which is that I can get a group of natives online together who want to play this game more easily than I can get, you know, the three kids on that live on the same block on my Cherokee reservation to get together and play this game. And so with the ability to like give out codes for Foundry or for Roll20 or finding ways to reach them in an online space and say, oh, hey, here, let me link you to the game and you can download it for, you know, a relatively small fee compared to a $70 book. I think that's going to go a long way to reaching new native players.
And I think that like, before we get too far, one of the things we have the opportunity to do on this podcast, in case there are any like inquisitive native or otherwise players who want to learn about the game, is probably in 4 years you've learned how to give us the quick lowdown on the world building and the characters and the play in a short form. Do you want to just kind of give that for anybody who's listening and maybe doesn't know?
Yeah, happy to do that. So Coyote and Crow is an alternate universe science fantasy role-playing game where you are taking on the role of epic heroes in a near future where colonization of the Americas never happened. You are playing characters that are in a world of spirituality, of science, of tradition meets the future. There are legends and lores of mythical beings that may or may not be true. There are warring factions and nations and tensions between governments. There's a whole lot of opportunity for drama in that world. The characters are based on six archetypes. They're not really as like maybe as important as class in D&D. The archetypes are more general, warrior, healer, things like that. But the thing I love about the game is that it's a quick, easy dice pool game. If you've ever played a game like Vampire the Masquerade or any other game that uses a dice pool, we use a dice pool of D12 to get a sense of collective success and degree of success in the game when you're playing. And then there are some things in there that I find that I really love, things like gifts and burdens and motivations that give characters a more grounded feel and give some direction to players in how their characters would make decisions. And then lastly, the legendary system of experience, which I really like, which is less about number creep on your characters and more about them evolving as these epic heroes and getting that sense of a hero's journey from beginning to end. And I love the idea that after every sort of overarching story, each player is supposed to tell their version of the story as though their character was the hero. So you get this sort of Rashomon kind of experience of everybody sees the story from their own perspective and they're the hero in their own stories. So yeah, I think that it's a good mix of like a lot of traditional RPG elements with hopefully some fresh takes on stuff.
And there's a thing I want to just pull out there because it's a very small thing, but it's also a very specific question of why the D12, especially for a dice pool system?
One of my favorite questions, actually. So as a kid, I grew up on D&D, and back then it was you were getting the tube sets of dice, the clear plastic tubes that always had like one of each die in it or whatever. And I always remember being so disappointed for whatever reason that the D12 was also like the least used dice, right? Like, how often were you using a D12? And then coincidentally later, I'm a bit of a pop science nerd and a pop math nerd, and I sort of started seeing articles about the duodecimal system, number systems based on 12 rather than 10. And as I was constructing the game, I thought, I don't want to just rely on either a base 10 numerology, which is coming out of, you know, Arabic systems and things like that. And I also don't necessarily want to rely on D&D's coattails for like having 8 different dice for the game. And so all of those things just sort of piled together. And I thought, wow, what if I picked out my favorite die, the D12, and then not just built a game's mechanic system around it, but it included it in world. Like, the number 12 is sacred in this world. And then the math all comes from 12. So yeah, it just kind of blossomed from there.
I really love the answer when the answer to a question is, I just really like it. it's always my favorite thing, kind of cutting through design.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You got to make what you love, right?
Yeah. I love the answer of, I just think the D12 is the coolest die. So fuck it. I'm going to make it the main die of my game.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Also, from a game mechanics perspective, it's not as swingy as the D20. Like, if you want to get really crunchy about it, it's not nearly as swingy as the D20. And on a curve, when you're dealing with dice pools, it allows for a much easier, like that sort of central curve of probability. It allows for a much more stable set of numbers. And you can do a lot more with that in terms of game design.
The other thing you mentioned about, like, one of the learnings is this idea of, like, you've put a lot of world building into this, like, mm-hmm. a lot of, like, really in-depth, fascinating world building.
Yeah.
And I want to dig into this a little bit more. And the question I always have when a game is so tied to its world, which is a thing that, like, you know, you see sometimes there's games that are, like, explicitly tied, and sometimes it's kind of world agnostic. How different does Makasing look from table to table, given kind of the tools you've provided in Coyote and Crow?
Wildly different from what I've seen. I think one of the things that's it's really hard to capture, because we don't really have a good example of it in our world. And the two that I often fall back on when I'm describing Coyote and Crow is the video game world of Horizon Zero Dawn and the comic book world of Wakanda. But both of those are deeply influenced by colonialism and capitalism. So if you're trying to create a world that doesn't have either of those elements at its core, what do people grip onto? And so one of the things that I've tried to push people when I have the chance to have, like, one-on-ones, is I direct them to go to Atlas Obscura and find places in Atlas Obscura in the continental United States that are not man-made structures, are not post-colonial structures at all, but just natural monuments. And look at some of the variety of beautiful, amazing places that exist in the U.S. that are really cool places. Underground lakes, caverns where there's a cavern where the temperature in the cavern stays at 78 degrees year-round, regardless of the temperature outside. It just stays that way. And it's just this weird combination of environmental factors that keeps the cavern very stable. And it's been used throughout the centuries by Native Americans for various ceremonial purposes. And there's all kinds of places like that that would exist in this alternate future, these natural monuments. I think it's easy for folks to latch on to certain futuristic elements. I mean, we have, you know, anti-gravity technology in the game. Everybody knows what, you know, anti-gravity technology looks like from a sci-fi perspective. We've all seen floating cars or whatever, solar panels, all these different things that I sort of adapted for this game from what we think of as maybe eco-friendly technology. But I think the thing that I always try to push my players toward is yes, these technologies exist, but unlike dystopias or these darker futures we see that are focused on capitalism, it's not like we spread across the land like a cancer. You know, and Makasing has roughly 40 million people in it. That's like 10% of America's population right now. So you've got a lot of wide open land, a lot of untouched land, and lands that's there to explore. And I think that beauty of America doesn't get mentioned enough in my games. I think a lot of players want to, I mean, and I'm not knocking their play styles or their choices or anything, but a lot of players, I think, want to engage in that kind of like urban drama. They want to be in a big city. And I'm like, that's great, but there's lots of stories to be told out in these amazing deep, dark forests or these cool rivers or canyons.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, it was one of those things where we were reading over the game in preparation for this interview, and Brian was reading the list of things that would not exist in an uncolonized North America, and like one of them was like chicken, and it's like there's just like there's just those things that like it's really hard to take your brain and imagine such a divergence in history. But it's, I think one of the ways that really is effective is like that, you all have been able to do is like the art, is so evocative and really puts you into that zone. I'm curious on the, cause I think some of the stuff you've mentioned from like the last 4 years, or maybe some of the things that, you feel like you've missed the mark on, or maybe like players haven't latched onto. What are sort of the like the inverses of that? What are these like really powerful, like positive things from the last 4 years as people have latched onto the game?
Yeah. So I keep hearing both directly and indirectly from educators, from counselors, from people in Native communities who have gotten a message to me letting me know just how deeply these games have affected them and their communities sometimes. I mean, I had a great conversation going back and forth with a person who was doing a study with troubled youth. And these troubled youth were all natives. They were all under 18, and they all had all kinds of problems, you know, at home and with criminal backgrounds and everything else. And all of them were deeply troubled kids. And they had started using role-playing games as a form of therapy, as a form of way for these kids to sort of build some communication tools. And they'd started with D&D, but when Coyote and Crow came out, they switched over to that. And the feedback she gave me was incredible. I mean, it was so charging for me, because not only were the kids getting along better because they sort of had a universe that they could latch onto that was hopeful and was connected to their own cultures, but they all reported self-identifying with their own native cultures more. They felt more tied in with their own native identities.
Oh, wow.
And she said that they even got to the point where they would have to tell the kids to stop playing and go home. They had to order them home. Ugh. And I was like, as a game designer, I don't think I could come up with a more, a better compliment, right? Like, that's so filling for my soul. I'm never going to, my game is, I don't think, ever going to speak to a chunk of people out in the role-playing game world who are the kind of folks who are really upset with me that white people are not in this game. And I can't really do anything about that. But what I can do is just keep producing stuff that affects people like the kids in that therapy group.
Wow, that's really beautiful.
The praise of the teachers had to tell them to go home feels very akin to the apocryphal story about Maurice Sendak. The guy who wrote Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah, I don't think I know the story.
Oh, there's a great story where a kid loved Where the Wild Things Are, and his mother wrote to Maurice Sendak, or I think maybe even the kid wrote to Maurice Sendak, and like with a picture of a wild thing, and Maurice Sendak was like very touched by it. And so like drew an original wild thing like for this kid and like signed it like totally unique. And a few weeks later, the mom wrote back to Maurice Sendak saying, thank you so much. My son loved your drawings so much that he ate it.
Oh my God.
No greater praise in the world than someone taking a priceless drawing, one of a kind drawing, being like, I love this so much, I have to eat it.
That's amazing. I love that. I kind of love that. That's brilliant. So yeah, I think those kind of things are what designers live for, right? It's not just I enjoy the game, but like this game touched me. This game made a real impact for me. And I think that's one of the things that just keeps me going as a designer. Like, it's certainly not the sales or the work or the quote-unquote getting wealthy, because that ain't happening.
what do you mean? Tabletop role-playing games are a surefire way to get super wealthy.
That's why we're all in it, right?
Look out, Elon Musk.
for them dollars.
So, Kenna, I want to transition a little bit to talking about genre. And like, there's a fun thing where with the base game, you went after like science fiction and fantasy and talked about like, what does science fiction and fantasy look like when they are divorced from the baggage of like capitalism and European influence. And now with, I want to start transitioning into Ahutiko a bit, because I'm curious about the horror genre for you and what it was like to dig into the horror genre with that same lens that you've kind of created for the game.
Yeah. So when I first came out with Coyote and Crow, there's a section in the book that talks about sort of like story hooks or story ideas. And we include like, you know, you can pick these different genres. You can do noir, you could do horror, you could do adventure, you could do war. And all those things are true in Coyote and Crow. And as I started thinking about like what was going to be my next full book sequel, because we did a bunch of one-shot stories called Stories of the Freelands that were all very sort of genre agnostic. They were meant to just be, you know, intros for folks to the game and get help them get a foothold on the world building. But as I thought about the books that I wanted to really focus on next, a lot of people wanted like regional source books. And that's fair, but I had native writers from all over the country, and I could slowly start to feel the tension brewing with my writers of like, who's going to get the first source book? And you know, knives weren't pulled or anything, but there were some heated conversations about who deserves to get the source, the next source book.
The knives were sharpened in the background.
I ended up sort of tabling that for the idea of rather than having like a big source book that, you know, covers a whole chunk of a continent and gives like very sort of broad descriptions of places and characters, I wanted to go the other direction and tell the story of a very small place. Because for me, as a lifelong game master, one of the things I love is creating really in-depth and interesting NPCs for my players. I want to create NPCs that have real life to them. And I think that having a small town where those characters are all interacting with each other is the perfect environment for that. And at the same time, I was reading Stephen Graham Jones' book called The Only Good Indian. And if you haven't read any of his horror, he focuses on indigenous horror. But I think the two of those things together, that idea of a small town and then and along with my love of David Lynch, and then reading The Only Good Indian, I just felt like, oh, I know what I need to do here. I need to take a specific tone and genre and highlight how you can use Coyote and Crow to tell these kinds of stories. And so that was the sort of birth of that. I was also greatly inspired, I think, by, this is going to date me a little bit, but like in the early, I was like early mid-2000s, I want to say like 2005, 2007, somewhere in there, Nine Inch Nails did a geocaching thing where they were putting all kinds of like hidden information in their music.
It was so rad.
Yeah.
It was really so cool.
I really wanted to create Ahutiko in a way that didn't just give players cool mysteries and plots and storylines, but I also wanted to have it have meta information that drew readers in who maybe weren't playing the game, but just wanted to read the book. So there's these hidden cryptography clues in the book that sort of work out to be codes that if you put them into the right place, you get multimedia elements that tie into the mysteries of Ahutiko. They give you more context and more information. There's audio and photos and documents and things like that. And I thought it would be a chance to have fun and let players really dive into these deep, dark mysteries.
Oh, like an ARG in the book. That's awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. That. Absolutely. Yeah. And there's an in-world municipal website for Ahutiko. It's basically ahutiko.com. Not basically, it is. It's ahutiko.com if you go there. And it's very... it takes itself very seriously as a crappy small town municipal website. It has a lot of dead links. It has a city map. It has a what's coming up on current events, but the current events are like 2 years old because nobody's updated the events page. It has this great feel to it that gives you the flavor of the town.
That's so great.
Hey, this is Brian, and I just want to tell you about some cool new stuff from our friends at Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop minis with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your web browser. Hero Forge is constantly releasing new content, and they've just launched their latest feature, custom acrylic keychains. These keychains use the same technology as their color standees and are the perfect way to rep your beloved character when you're out in the world. They are highly detailed, ridiculously durable, and made of 1/8-inch thick acrylic featuring front and back color printing, measured on the same 30mm scale as Hero Forge minis and standees, which means they will be a one-for-one match for your heroes on the battle map. Plus, Hero Forge just released stainless steel minis. These are perfect for anyone who is looking for the retro feel of old-school minis. These stainless steel minis have a textured finish and a rugged, highly durable feel. So visit heroforge.com to start designing your custom keychains and steel minis today.
My dearest listener, have I got a secret for you? Bitcherton is an improvised comedy podcast inspired by the stories of Jane Austen that tells the tale of a wealthy family's secrets, scandals, and shenanigans. Lady Bitcherton has unwed daughters, nosy neighbors, awful country cousins, and now a body to hide. Will the Bitchertons be able to keep their secrets off the pages of Lady Bigwither's gossip sheet? Or will her pen skewer their good name forever? Oh, Bits, what a predicament. Featuring the voices of Katie Maravich, Iffy Waddyway, Carolyn Page, Alex Songsharp, Brian Flaherty, and Cassie Wilson, plus a dance card filled with guest comedians of the very finest quality. But for us to help the seeds of rumor ripen into the juicy plum of scandal, we'll need your help. Bitcherton is heading to Kickstarter on June 13th. Go to bitcherton.com to pre-save the campaign and help us bring this story to life. Ta-ta for now.
One of the first pages in the book that like strikes you when you're scrolling through or flipping through, if you have it physically, I was scrolling, is in giant letters. It says, "This book tells lies." and that immediately made me go, "Ooh, what's that about?" Could you say more about what "This book tells lies" is kind of getting at?
Yeah. Two things. First of all, that's a nod to my own Cherokee culture. Cherokees, well, and a number of other native cultures have this as well, is that the idea of storytelling and lies are parallel to each other. There's this idea that the truth only comes out when you experience it yourself, firsthand information. Anything after that is a lie. It's not necessarily an evil lie or a malicious one, but it's not the truth anymore. And so I wanted to acknowledge that idea that Coyote and Crow is very much about a storytelling game, and therefore it's about lies. So there's that very literal reading of it. But then I also wanted to go back and say, this book's an unreliable narrator. You can't trust anything in this book. I might be giving you a piece of information in this book and stating it as though it's a rule or a fact, when it's absolutely not. And so I wanted a lot of the mysteries and the stories in the book to have not necessarily open ends, but hidden ends in a way that allowed storytellers who were playing the game to bring their own personalities into the story. I mean, that's one of my favorite things about Indigenous storytelling, is so much of it is through this lens of the storyteller themselves and how much of that their personality comes through on their version of the story. So with Ahutiko, I'm hoping that these storytellers that play the game sit down with the material and come up with their own endings, their own answers to these mysteries, and I can't wait to hear what some of those are going to be. That's a real joy.
That's the juice.
That's the juice, baby.
Yeah.
It's a trend that I'm increasingly delighted by, of like game designers playing around with the idea of like unreliable text and antagonistic text. We're good friends with the folks who made Triangle Agency, and that text is like so doesn't want you to know the truth of the matter.
Very combative. I haven't played that or read through it yet, and I'm so excited to check that out.
Oh yeah, highly recommend.
It's good.
Yeah, absolutely.
You also did an interesting thing with the publication of Ahutiko that I'm curious to hear about, in that you had two versions of the game. You had the standard version and the knight version. Can you tell us what those two versions are and also why you made the choice to have two different versions of the game?
One of the things I wanted to do with Ahu Tico originally was that I wanted to present very mature stories in a way that tackled some content that I don't think is necessarily maybe like convention friendly, where you might have like 13 or 14 year olds playing. I wanted that the impact of some of those stories to feel more weighty. I don't want to say games always treat death casually, but I wanted the deaths and the some of the heavier mysteries in this game to feel like they had real cultural weight to them, especially because, you know, in the real world, natives are dealing with a very high rate of you know, having people go missing, being murdered, addiction, all of these other things. And I wanted to be able to tackle them in a realistic and respectful way while also not cutting off a large chunk of my audience because of age or a lack of interest in connecting with those materials. So I decided that early on that I wanted two versions. The Night Edition has that more raw, unedited, I like to describe it as like a rated R movie. It has a rated R film kind of vibe to it. It has an alternate cover with a textured material on it. It has a bookmark in it. And the art is slightly different. I've edited the art. Well, the art is raw in that version. It's the R-rated version, and we edited it down for the standard edition. So we've taken out, you know, the nipples, the genitals on some of the art, because some of the art, not all of it, but some of it has nudity or sexuality in it. And then we edited, and when I say edited, we did not change the text. I very specifically did not want to change the text for the standard edition. I literally just redacted certain paragraphs that I thought were over the line that didn't need to be in a quote-unquote PG-13 version of the book. The standard edition has all of the same content, mysteries, everything else. It just has some of the text tweaked a little bit down for the right audience and some of the art tweaked down.
And when you were looking from, when you were taking like the Night version and going in that like redaction and that process of eliminating certain elements, what were the like lines for you where you think like, okay, now this belongs, now this should be redacted and should only be in the Night version versus what do you think does make it through? Like, did you have a standard there?
To some degree, it was my own judgment. I also passed this on to some of the other people that I was working with internally on this, which was, compared to the original core book, was a very small team. I did the 99% of the writing in this book as me. And I went back and, oh, like a perfect example is Bayance. Bayance is a place in the city of Ahu Tico that is a house, a location for sex workers, for organized sex workers. And I just didn't feel like rewriting that in a way that would work for a 13 or a 14-year-old. I thought, there's nothing here that needs to be in here for a 13 or 14-year-old. So I just redacted that. Or for a more specific example, there's a drug in the game mentioned called Misix. And during one of the descriptions I mentioned in the Night Edition, there's a mention of a consent violation, a sexual consent violation. And I thought, you know, for the standard edition, I just don't need that in here. It adds depth in the Night Edition, but it doesn't add value in the standard edition. So I just decided to redact the sexual consent issue in the standard edition.
There's an interesting thing that I think is like fun and unique to the horror genre, where like sometimes a PG-13 horror movie can be scarier than an R movie. Like sometimes when you don't get all the sort of explicit details, you like your imagination's able to fill it in. And I think about like the way teenagers see horror versus how we do. So it's fun to imagine that like I could see a bad faith read of this being like,
absolutely,
you're taking the fun out. But I think that there's some ways where you're giving space to imagination in horror.
That's what I hope comes out of it. And I hope that the folks who have the standard edition don't feel like they've been robbed of anything. I don't think they will. All of the good parts of the book are still there. You know, it's really just a bit of fluff and a bit of heavy stuff and a bit of nudity that's been redacted. Everything else is still there. One of the things that I am really interested in seeing is the reaction from the broader RPG community from the Night Edition, specifically regarding the fact that there is a character in the book who's portrayed a trans character who's portrayed naked in the Night Edition. And, you know, I think trans bodies in general are not always portrayed in a positive light or in a healthy light. And I'm going to be really interested to see just how people react to that, because it actually goes back to the core book. When I was talking with my artists, because we had, I think it was more than 30 artists on the original core book, I emphasized the idea that I wanted to portray people in the book as real human beings. So, you know, we have people with physical disabilities. We have there's two different portrayals of pregnant people in the book. There's multiple portrayals of multi-generational families. One of the characters on the core book is intentionally non-binary. I wrote them as non-binary and trans. I never called that out, but that was the art direction to my art director. So I think from the beginning, I think just because Native Americans have such crap portrayal in game media, I wanted to kind of swing it the other way and go, let's bring all marginalized people along on this ride, you know, if we can. So I think that's always been a goal for me in my art representation.
Yeah, I love that. So kind of rounding out our thoughts on Ahutiko here, I want to kind of tease for folks who maybe are into the core game, maybe haven't picked up Ahutiko yet, maybe didn't get in on that Kickstarter. What is the new player stuff that people can get excited about? How does the experience change on the player side?
On the player side, you're going to encounter some of the things that I've included in the book that I really like are that all of the NPCs have secrets. There's a basic skill in the game, investigation, and then there are the social skills like charm and coercion. All of those are sort of engaged when you're trying to glean information from NPCs, right? But rather than just having a success or failure or a paragraph saying, this is what this character knows, and then, you know, oh, you got a high enough roll, so you now know what the character knows, I wanted to go the other way and say, here's a list of secrets these characters have, some about themselves, some about other people, and here's the level at which they would give up that information. And some of the information they have about other people may not be true. And I really make it a point to call out the fact that human beings do not like to give up their own secrets. They'll often lie rather than tell the truth in that situation. So I wanted to give story guides and players this complex feeling of these characters living lives where, yeah, sure, they want to help you solve the mystery, but they don't want to give up their own personal dirt in order to make that happen. And they'll throw someone else under the bus before they do that. That's kind of like, I mean, I don't want to say it's human nature, but a lot of people do it, right? So there's that. But then there's also a massive rumor table in the game we created, just a rumor table about everything that a small town can have rumors about. It's 144 rumors on a 2d12 random table if you want to do the random stuff. So I'm really proud of those things because I hope that they're going to give the players a sense of being in a real place that as they interact with these NPCs, there's going to be a push and pull. And it's not just, I don't know, it's not like that whole D&D environment where you can just go in and start a brawl in a bar and walk out from it and have no repercussions, right? If you walk into the equivalent of a bar in Ahutiko and start a fight, everybody in town is going to know about it by the next day and be giving you the side eye.
Right. That's fun. You're grabbing those stories that I think you were saying you didn't see people explore as much of, like, smaller locations.
Yeah, I mean, how often in a role-playing game do players just breeze through a small village, if you're talking about a fantasy setting, just to get enough information to pursue the plot? You know, there's the one character who's going to give you all the exposition or the reward or whatever it is. I think those tropes, you know, when I was 12 were fine, but as an adult RPGer, I want real motivations. And I also like that idea of creating people who, yes, they might be liars. Yes, they might have secrets. Are they a bad person though? And how do you define what a bad person is? And all of these people live in kind of a gray space. I mean, and that's human beings, not to sound pessimistic about humanity, but I think we're all slightly in the gray, right?
Absolutely.
Looking at Ahutiko and the horror genre specifically as it relates to Coyote and Crow, are there any other bits of advice that you would give to new storytellers, new players specifically who are interested in picking up this setting book and playing, to get into the heart of like what you're trying to do here?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I think horror is a very specific subgenre of RPGs that I think horror is a lot of elements, right? Like horror, I think, is a broad umbrella term for a lot of elements. You have suspense, you have dread, you have terror, you have all of these different words you can throw under there. They're all slightly different meanings. And I think if you're just reading text from a book like Ahutiko, you're probably not going to get much horror out of it. It's just facts on a page, right? Like it's not a narrative like a Stephen Graham Jones novel. So I think the horror comes out of these when you start adding in other elements like smells and sounds and lighting and adjusting your environment. So I don't have an official list or anything, but the more I think you can immerse players in the vibe of Ahutiko, I mean, hell, if I could have a group of players go out and play in a forest, I think that would be amazing. You know, just to get those raw natural sounds that you're going to hear in a forest that can be, you know, especially if it's dark, can be a little disquieting. So I think setting a mood for horror is more important than anything. I recently wrote a one-shot for the second edition of Free League's Alien RPG, and I'm really excited for that to get out in the world. And when we play tested it, not only did I have the entire room set up in small LED red lights, but I had an alien soundtrack, like a 6-hour alien soundtrack mix playing in the background. I had sound effects set up on my laptop so that at any moment I could play a great alien sound effect. You know, all the players had these tiny little pin lights over their character sheets so that all the main lights were off, but they could still see their character sheets. Those kind of things, I think, are important in horror. I think you really have to set the stage if you want your players scared.
I just played last night in my first ever game of Mothership with some friends.
Oh, yeah.
Which was very fun. And the GM had, or the warden had, like, spooky music on in the background. We dimmed the lights. And this was a group that was prone to goofs and gags. And it was very much going to be like a straight horror night. And we definitely had some goofs and gags, but as the night went on, like that atmosphere kept kind of infecting us until by the end of it, we were like, oh no, that we're in the serious world.
I love that. Yeah. Yeah. That's what it's all about, I think. I mean, don't get me wrong. I am fully for making jokes and having comedy in your RPGs. I have no problem with that at all. We have a couple of players who have always made jokes about the fact that they're native players, and they're upset about the fact that there's no fry bread in this world because fry bread wouldn't exist. And so they're like, I don't want to live in this world. There's no fry bread. Those kind of jokes, I think, are always going to crack me up. But yeah, with horror, I definitely think it takes immersion because we're so numb to that stuff.
So Kenna, as we kind of start to bring this conversation towards a close, round the corner towards a close, I want to make sure we get into the Kickstarter that's currently running for Coyote and Crow Digital. So I know we talked a little bit about that at the top, but could you give us a sense of the scope of what you're funding with this Kickstarter?
Yeah, so this is sort of like a weird mishmash of odds and ends people had been asking for a while. When Coyote and Crow was first coming out, we had partnered with Roll20, but it was at an odd time when Roll20 was in the midst of changing their back-end code. And so Coyote and Crow ended up becoming the first first content to have that new code. But it was more or less an alpha version, and it didn't get updated for a long time. I didn't have the resources for it, and it was really buggy. And I think that did a big disservice to Roll20 fans who wanted to access that stuff. At the same time, I had the core rules up on Foundry, but just the core and nothing else. I didn't have the funds for adapting Stories of the Freelands or anything else. So as we got closer to Ahutiko being released, I realized that, like, if I really want to start reaching this digital crowd, I need to update all this content. And I just didn't have the funds for it. The folks at Metamorphic Digital who are helping me with this are great, but they need to be paid. And so talking with them, I realized that there was a couple of other things that had coming out of polling my fans. And that was that they really wanted an actual play. There's been a few. Hero Forge did a really nice actual play. But we wanted one that was a little beefier, a little better produced, and was a little more immersive. And I just thought that Ahutiko was the perfect content for that kind of thing. Indigenous horror is seeing a big upswing, and I think and horror in general in RPGs is seeing an upswing. So I thought, well, this is the perfect time to put all these into a pile. So there's a few other things on there, too, that we're looking for stretch goals, like another tea blend from Friday Afternoon Tea, who did did a blend called the Cahokia blend, which is really good. We want to get some print-on-demand files for Stories of the Freelands for folks who, you know, love having a physical book in their hand. One of the things we are offering also on the current Kickstarter is a chance for folks to purchase games that they missed out on from previous Kickstarters. So we have things like Wolves, which is our semi-cooperative game about community survival. That's available to pledge for. And then once you pledge for Wolves, you can get all the other digital rewards you want, or all the other physical rewards can be added on as well. And then we have a game, Nossi, which is a dice game, very similar to it's kind of a Yahtzee kind of feel, but with some indigenous twists on it. It's sort of a push your luck, roll and write. But the nice thing about the game is that it is a set of 12-sided die that also match the RPG. So if you're looking for a board game, but then also a set of die for the RPG, it covers both your bases. So there's a few things like that. But really, this is, and this is kind of a tease for what's coming up. This is all a stage for me as I'm gearing toward my next Kickstarter, which we're going to be announcing during this Kickstarter. And that is for the next big book for Coyote and Crow that people have been demanding since 2021. I'll drop the name here, because if you're a Coyote and Crow fan, you'll figure out what the book's going to be. But the book's called Legends and Icons, and I'm really excited about it. We've already got the cover art for it done, and we'll be unveiling the cover art during the Kickstarter. But really, so this Kickstarter, this Coyote and Crow digital Kickstarter, is really just to kind of help us fill out this digital world and prep us for Legends and Icons, which is coming up.
Cool. That's exciting.
And at time of recording, you guys have already funded your core goal, which was, I believe, $10,000. And you are well on your way to your stretch goal of $25,000, which is where that actual play co-produced by Many Sided Media and Tales Yet Told and Kendrick Smith gets green lit to go. So if anyone here is listening and is loving what they're hearing about Coyote and Crow and wants to hear that actual play, go check out this Kickstarter and help us make it happen.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'll say this, too, that, like, even if for some reason we didn't get that funding, I really want to try to make an actual play happen. I don't know how or when or what the details would be, but I honestly feel like Ahutiko is something that needs to be brought to life. So, you know, even if we have to have it as a stretch goal the next time down the line, you know, for Legends and Icons, I'd do that if I had to.
But then, dear listener, you'll have to wait longer. Don't do that.
Don't make us all wait longer. Don't do that.
Kendo is chomping at the bit to sink their teeth into this horror, and we can't wait to see what
absolutely.
They make.
And as far as Ahutiko goes, it is not available through this current Kickstarter, and I feel bad about that, but that's partly because backers from the previous campaign, from the Ahutiko campaign, just got their PDFs, and the book is in the middle of its print run right now, so I didn't want to offer it because I don't know exactly when those materials are going to arrive because of tariffs and everything else. I want to make sure that, like, nobody is backing something for this Kickstarter that they're then delayed unnecessarily on. 100%. So,
but you can grab it digitally. Right.
What's that?
But you can grab it digitally, it looks like, as part of the campaign.
Not yet. We're gonna release the digital version at the same time as the physical version. So hopefully before the end of this year, the production cycle of it, of the physical books, is on track. And you can do a pre-order from the book through Allplay's website. Allplay's our sales partner, and allplay.com, and you can find the both of the versions of the book there, the night edition and the standard edition. Although I will say the night edition is a one-time print only. We're not going to go back and print that again, so it's limited number.
Oh,
okay.
Fascinating. This is such a final left turn before we go into our final question, but you just mentioned it, and I remembered this. Allplay is one of your distribution partners, which, when I remember seeing the email, was such a shock to me, as Allplay I only knew from, like, small board games.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that business relationship. We can sneak a little bit of business in here, right? At the end.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll try not to make it dry. So I used to work for a company before I designed games. I worked for a company called PSI, Publisher Services Inc. There's this sort of like distributor within distributors kind of organization. And I was with them for Coyote and Crow. They warehoused all my stuff. They did all of my fulfillment for the first 4 years. And then early this year, I decided to make the jump to Allplay. Allplay has, they publish their own games. They do their own Kickstarters, but they also work with a number of other publishers, including folks like Druid City Games. And I'm friends with James over at Druid City Games. And I started looking for alternatives, folks who had more experience handling Kickstarters than PSI did, folks who were a little more in touch with hobby gamers and publishers of my size. And after some conversations with them, they were looking and still are looking to bring on publishers of my size, folks where, you know, they can handle the sales quickly, they can handle the Kickstarter fulfillment well. For me, as a company of one full-time employee, they take a lot of the load off of me handling all of my sales and distribution. So that's been really nice working with them, and I'm excited for them to distribute Ahutiko. It was a little awkward because they hadn't done digital distribution before, so we had some hiccups getting the Ahutiko PDF out. But, you know, it's just first-time stumbles. We got through it.
That's awesome. Well, we're both huge Allplay fans here on the board game side, so very excited to see them getting into RPGs, and I hope that continues to be a good relationship. That's awesome.
Yeah, thank you. I think it will. They're good folks, and we communicate well.
Kenna, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been great talking to you. We have one question that we always ask everyone who comes on the show, and that question is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking you for a recommendation of anything that you think our listeners might enjoy. This could be a game, a show, a resource. It could be inside of tabletop, outside of tabletop. We've had people say they recommend going for a walk. We've had people say they recommend reading this, you know, dry academic paper. It could be truly anything. Ken Alexander, what do you bring to the table?
Right now, I'm really enjoying the read from a fellow native author, somebody who did contribute it to Coyote and Crow. Her name is Wiyote Oldbear. She wrote a book called More Ships Than Stars. It's a science fiction book about the Navajo Diné folks going into space. And that's really good. And then I'm also enjoying pretty much all of the games right now from Kids Table Board Games, especially Creature Comforts. Like, we've been playing a lot of Creature Comforts in my house.
That's a familiar.
Seen that one, but I will definitely check it out.
If you've ever played Everdell, to me, it feels like Everdell, but better. And I'm not trying to slam Everdell when I say that. I really like Everdell. But Creature Comforts is this cozy little game where you're playing an animal who's trying to make a cozy home before winter happens. It's super cute and relaxing.
We play a lot of, my wife and I play a lot of Wingspan on like our lunch breaks. So we love a kind of cozy-esque game to play.
Yeah. If you're a Wingspan fan, you will love Creature Comforts.
Hell yeah.
Oh yeah. We will, of course, link all that in the show notes. Thank you so much, Ken Alexander, for coming to the table. One more time, do you want to let our audience know where they can find you and where they can find the Coyote and Crow Digital crowdfunding going on right now, Kickstarter?
Yes, so you can find my current Kickstarter campaign on Kickstarter at Coyote and Crow Digital. Then you can also find out pretty much everything you need to know about our company and our games at coyoteandcrow.net. That has all of links to our socials. We've got a great Discord there. And then we also have a YouTube channel that has a lot of background videos on Coyote and Crow if you're looking for things about like our language or general setting or rules. Oh, yeah. And then ahutiko.com. If you want to take a weird meta look into the little village of Ahutiko, just go to ahutiko.com.
And of course, as always, if you want more gamey content from us here at Talk of the Table, please check out the Many-Sided newsletter and join us on the Many-Sided Media Discord, where you can chat about this conversation and all our conversations. You can support Talk of the Table on the Many-Sided Media Patreon, where you get bonus roundtables, ad-free episodes, as well as a whole bunch of great stuff for this show and My First Dungeon. All of that is linked in our show notes. As always, please rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.